Okay. The title of the talk this evening is really a question. What fills the space in our heart? And constantly in spiritual life and in the Dharma practice and in the Buddhist practice specifically, and in the language, Simi, myself, the language of space. We use the language of space and freedom as spacious. And it's interesting language. We can perhaps see it more clearly why this language is used. By the opposite. What's the opposite? Contraction, limitation, restriction, feeling the world against, feeling against us, feeling we have no room, feeling we can't breathe, feeling, and we can really see the problems of life making us go like this. And that's the word contraction, it kaptut. So it really can help us to ask the question, what fills the space in our mind and in our heart? And today we're under so much pressure as a community, as a society, and maybe as a planet. And we're very busy with coping, hitmodudut, with concerns, with trying to fix things, with the struggle to try and get things better, to try and understand why things are so difficult, to try and kind of fix life. But the trouble is, with all that trying to fix life with our good heart, we end up losing life because we're so busy trying to fix it and control it, in a way we lose it. Because we're busy with survival. And there's something there that we really have to understand, that as living beings, not just human beings, once we're born in a body, and we didn't ask to be born in a body, we just were dumped in this life. There you go. Make the best of it. What? Where am I? Why did you do that to me? There's a very long tradition of the Buddha being born again and again and again and again and again in order to each time to go back to school and to learn the lesson that he didn't learn before. This is the Jataka stories of the paramis that he had to learn each time. He was born as a parrot. He was born as an elephant. He was born as a, in order each time to go to, back to school. So in a way, we're born in a body to go back to school. Try again. And when you've finished Bagrut, you've done it, you don't need to be born. That's quite a big mystery, which I won't go into now. But it's important that what's called the eight worldly winds, the winds of the world, the pressure to survive, that we want things to be better, we want to control things, we want to survive, we want things to be, we want to be happy and not to sad, we want to have life and not to lose it, we want to be loved. And it's every creature, not just humans, are affected by the eight worldly winds. But it's important for us to see it as a truth and not a problem. That the, once we're born in a body, the pressure to survive is a truth of things and not just a mistake. So the Dharma practice is not about denying this truth. It's not ideal to kind of we imagine ideal place of absolute spiritual perfection, and then we're not there, and we try and get there, and we don't know why it doesn't happen. Instead of that, we give respect and interest to the truth of what happens when we're born in a body and struggle to survive. And the Dharma just looks at it as a truth. The pressure to survive does things to us. And it's very important because it's fundamental to the Dharma, actually. There's many spiritual religious paths that go, in a way, into the rainbow world. But the Dharma says, no, the Buddha said again and again, the truth of things is that we are pressured to survive. It's a contracted place. We need to listen to it. We need to be interested in it and then open that and go beyond it without denying it or closing it down. Now, it is true that we can, for example, in deep quiet, in jhana, in deep concentration, in meditative concentration, we can be in a very pure place where we don't need to pay attention to all of this. And in traditional language, karma stops. We can pause, put the pause button on karma for a while, going into deep retreat, very deep quiet. Not much is happening. I don't need to be interested in survival. It's true. We can stop. We can do that. And it's quite precious to be able to do that. But it's not the total story, because when we come out of deep quiet, we're faced with, like Jack Kornfield said, 10 years in the monastery or whatever, and then he went back to New York and he met his mother. I don't know if you read his book, but it's as if everything went, all collapsed. But of course, not really. But we need to be interested without lobe cheshbon, not at the expense of denial of survival mind, of the contracted places. But what opens up when we get close to the truth of things? And that's the path. And it's when we do that, and it's not so difficult, the whispers of authenticity, of truth, of love will be there. It's not so difficult. We already maybe touched it in this retreat in one day. How many amazing reminders that we've been getting now in one day. It means we already have it in us. It's not we invent anything. It's already there. Just in this community here, this Sangha, the refuge, with nature, with the teachings, we already have it. So as soon as we're interested in the place of contraction and the place of what is not contracted, then we hear the whispers, the hints of a much bigger place of connectedness, being, belonging to this world, refuge, connected, chibur. So in our practice, the first place to can find our freedom is in the contraction itself, is just what I was saying before. Not to ignore it, but more than that, to actually open it. What happens that makes me want to control life? What is it, the pressure to control and fix life? It's a very basic, important question. And it's in one word, dukkha, the dissatisfaction, basically, the pressure to get things better, that pressure that things should be other than they are. We all feel it. If I asked you, you know, who here thinks that things should be other than they, different from what they are, there won't be one person that doesn't put up their hand, including us here. We all, it's so basic. But instead of just suffering it, dukkha of the struggle of life and then the pressure to control or to that things should be other, dukkha for us becomes a teacher, becomes our guide, becomes a place to look at. And that's where it gets interesting. So the contracted place in us isn't a problem. It's part of the mystery. Let me look at this contracted place. Let me hold it. This is part of being born in a body. I'll hold it. What is vulnerability? Pagiyut, what is it? Let me see it. Let me feel it. Let me understand it. Let me work with it. It's chomagelem. It's a raw material of our liberation. Things are not perfect. But does that mean there is no perfection? The question. In the Jewish tradition, God made the world perfect. Yom Shishi. And then Shabbat. It's done. I did. The world is perfect. All you need to do is rest. So it's an interesting question and something to explore. Not, again, not something that the dukkha is not a kind of mistake. It's an invitation to be authentic and look at the truth of things. And we'll find pleasant, unpleasant. And maybe you're going to hear more about that tomorrow. This is the name of the game. We are all day experiencing pleasant, unpleasant, or just neither. But that's the raw material. And when the unpleasantness is strong, and it is, it, for many of us, it's been very strong. There's been real violence and death. There's war. When the unpleasantness has been very, very strong, then it becomes urgent as a wake-up call. I can't just allow it like that. It is a wake-up call. What is going on? And how can I be with this? Not just trying to fix it, undo it, run away from it, or it's okay to go to Portugal. It's really fine. It's not a problem, but I don't think we can get, run away from dukkha in Portugal. So it's a wake-up call, and the Buddha said, when there's strong pain, you have a choice, misery or search, chipus. There's your choice. So what we need to do is actually give space to this struggle. So the contraction of difficulty and struggle, give it space and it begins to open. It shows us things. I was writing recently about Evel, mourning, on one of my newsletters. I was writing a piece on mourning and quite a sense of how mourning and grief, which seems a sort of place of contraction, actually, if we are there with it, it opens up to a bigger, bigger space of compassion, of life itself, of letting go into things that we can't control. And it's authentic meeting with what we can't control, and we feel grief. It's okay. Loss. Loss is not a problem. Loss is an invitation to let go, to see that we can let go. We can't hold on to things. So loss is a teacher. Loss, uvdan, is a teacher. It tells us you can let go. And it all helps us to take things less personally. And that's where we talk about the space. We are invited by difficulty of life to see there's a bigger place which is not just personal. So all of us, when we feel pain, this one little place that say, wait a minute, it's on my shoulders, yes, but is it really? Do I have to carry the pain of human society and others and of the whole? Do I have to carry it all? I can feel it. I have to feel it because it's there. But there is something about the big picture. We don't have to. We can feel pain in the body, for example. We don't have to turn it into the pain of life that I have to carry on my poor little shoulders. So we don't have to take samsara, which is the wheel of life, too personally. It's just the way things are once we're born in a body. So when we start to practice with these questions, we will begin to see things beyond the personal, the contracted place of I'm struggling, I need to fix life. We're bound to experience a bigger space. It will happen by itself. We're doing it already. When we breathe, we are breathing the world in us, giving us life. Does it belong to us, this breath? Does the oxygen belong to us? Just breathing, just connecting with the simple breathing is already a place which is more spacious, which is more open. The body, the trees, the mind that is not ours really, it's consciousness. Did we invent consciousness? Does it belong to you? Anyone can say, I have consciousness, I put it in my pocket. I'll sell it in the market in Machane Yehuda. It doesn't belong to us. It arrived, all these places, all these powers. And so the voices of life show us that there is being, and it's bigger than us. It doesn't belong to us. And slowly, slowly, we'll understand this bit more. We'll open that. We'll feel the voices. And the space is already there. And the voices of the trees and the earth and the body and the consciousness and the breath, they're already there. And so that's why, as Simi said earlier, sati is remembering. It's about remembering that we already know all of this, but we forget it because the space inside is taken up by struggle. And that's where we need to really do. Our practice needs to be there to see without blame, to see how much space is taken up in the heart and mind. How much space is busy with survival, with coping, with struggle, with control, with trying to fix things, with complaining. I was joking, I just come back from England. I nearly didn't come to this retreat, by the way, because of the problems with flights and so on, but I managed. And in England, you know, if you meet someone in a pub and you ask them how they are, the classic answer is, mustn't complain. Not only I want to complain, but I'm not allowed to complain. I don't think that's an Israeli response. So if we need to look and see how much we invest in the contracted place, how much space is taken up. And it's very tricky because it's coming in where we don't even notice how much space is taken up in our daily life by pain, by the media, by the stories, by the struggle, by the narratives of, you know it, and how difficult it is to come out of that. But yet it's stealing our space. All of the more time we spend getting hijacked by stuff, we'll find it fills the space. And it's not because we are stupid. It's because we're sensitive. Our heart is open, so it gets filled with stuff coming in, and we need to have understanding where we get our attention gets taken, and bring it back, and see that our attention can be to life. The voices of life, the voices of our body, the voices of our mind, the voices of the trees. We need to win back our attention. So I won't go into it too much now, but the three characteristics or the three seals, which is dukkha, anicca, and anatta, are really the classic places, I would say, the deeper truth of experience. And dukkha, I talked about. Anicca is this sense that everything we experience just slips through our fingers. And there is a relief in that. It means we don't actually have to hold on to stuff because it just passes through our fingers anyway, like water. We can't hold on. Everything passes through us. And that's nature of life. So anicca is also, in a way, a kind of a relief that everything passes through. We can't hold on to things. And anatta, a subjective point of view, the personal point of view, practice will show us bit by bit that we can't. It's not all me. It's not about me. And we can a little bit let go. And we're doing it already, like I said before. We open the gaze, mabat. We open the view, and we see that actually we're part of. It's not all me. So slowly, slowly. It doesn't happen in 5 minutes. But so one of the themes here that we've been talking about already, and I gave it importance in the guidance of walking meditation, one of the themes is we have to let the world in. Let the world in. And we find that if we allow the voices of the world, of our body, of the mind, of the trees, of the sky, of the earth, we call it Satya Dharma, the truth of Dharma. It's a truth, and it works. It comes in. We just have to have no barrier to it, no resistance. Let the voices of the world talk to us. They are gifts to us. They are the gifts. So, because the voices talk to our heart, this is indeed a heart practice. And the heart opens to these voices of the world. And the heart opens to something beyond the place of hitamodudut, of contraction. It's the heart that opens. The mind follows the heart with all kinds of parshanut and all kinds of stories and all kinds of this. But the heart is actually leading in a way. And if we think about it, the heart already knows to be totally with the world. It already knows. I mean, it's happened by itself. What about in the neurological world, mirror neurons? We read each other's faces all the time, automatically. We know what the other feels. We know what's going on. Our heart is reading all the time, the voices very, very immediately. It means that we were never separate. We're always connected. We're constantly letting the world in anyway. It's just that we forget. The world is coming in whether we like it or not, or don't. The last retreat I was here, this woman is here in this retreat as well, I don't know. But in one of the groups, there was a woman that was telling a small story about something that happened to her during the day. And there were tears in her eyes. And she said, I spent 20 minutes watching an ant, Nimala Echad, trying to put a stick into its nest, and it couldn't. And it struggled, and it struggled, and it struggled, and in the end gave up. And she said, I feel like I am the ant. The ant is me. And she was in tears. And I could sort of, it's so beautiful, the sense. She and the ant were in that moment one together. It sounds crazy. Huh? Only in retreat would you hear that story like that. But we feel the other. We know the other. The other is an ant. The other is ourselves. The other is each other. The other is the world. We feel the pain of the other. And that's the basis of all the Brahmaviharas, the basis of all the love in the world. The Dhammapada says, having empathy for others, we see that all beings love life and fear death. And knowing this, we cannot harm or cause harm to others. Because that's us. We are them. We're not separate. We're not different. And the basis of ethics and the basis of how we are in life is just that empathy that we are not different. So this sense of fundamental belonging and being held by everything, a deep truth that is nature, it's in nature. It's not something that we have to discover. It's not something that we need to hunt for. It's every day for us. When I get up in the morning, I go out to the vegetable garden. I look at the garden, maybe pick some vegetables for lunch. We'll go and feed the chickens. They give me eggs. I give them food. We're in a cycle of relationship. I'm them. They are me. I feed them. They feed me. Who's doing? I don't know. Who's doing this thing? I don't know. There's a nice, also in the Dhammapada, image of how we are in life. We're like a bee, or we can be like a bee going from flower to flower and taking the tzuf from each flower and passing on. And the flower needs to give to the bee, and the bee needs to take the flower, and nobody's hurt. And I read recently, someone did some research, actually in Tel Aviv University, that when a flower hears a bee coming, the flower makes a quick burst of sugar in the tzuf. And it happens very fast. But only when a bee comes, when there's a fly or any other noise, the flower knows and doesn't give any sugar. Just when the flower quickly makes more. The interaction of everything, the connection with everything. I've got a nice sutta here that I want to kind of bring up. So some of the Buddha's monks were walking in the village, and they're very traditional, so they have lunch at lunchtime. They only take, this is 2,500 years old, okay? So they're in the village, they take food from the villagers give them food, but they need to do it in the middle of the day, and it was early. So they said, let's go to the place of the sadhus. Let's talk to them. And the sadhus said to them, what do you practice? And they said, we practice the Brahma Viharas. And how do you do that? Oh, and here, this is relevant. All through the Buddhist texts, the practice of Brahma Viharas is practiced through tether, through vibration, or and it's an energetic practice. So they practice it by radiating the energy of love through all the world, the energy of compassion, sending it out through the world as a vibration. The energy of joy, sending it out through the world. The energy of balance and steadiness, sending it out through the world. So it's a very subtle practice, but it's based on the fact that we're already belonging to the world. I don't need to kind of I just need to feel that my heart is already in the world. And so their practice is of expanding this in an energetic way. So that's what the monk said. And the sadhu said, well, that's what we do already. You guys are nothing special. We already do that. We practice compassion just like that. So the monks didn't quite know what to say. So they went back to the Buddha and said, this is what happened. And we got a bit stuck. Can you tell us what's unique and special about the practice we do? And the Buddha said, yes, I can. That if you ask, so what is the fruit and the destination? What will happen then if you go further and further and further to the end of this practice? Of vibration of love, vibration of compassion, vibration of joy, vibration of equanimity. What's the fruit? What's the peak? Where is it taking you? They will not be able to answer that question. And I don't know who can answer that question except me, said the Buddha. So he said, look, our practice is this, that, and it's important to we work with the factors of awakening, which I won't go into now, but it's basically the awareness factors, such as, you could say, vipassana practice. So it's based on a practice of awareness, of exploring the truth, what I was saying just before, exploring the nature of things. So the factors of awakening are there. energy, calm, concentration, exploration, etc. So they're bases. And then we, from that place, we go out and practice endless love without limits, without spreading love, spreading compassion. And the Buddha said, so what's the end of the practice of love, vibration of love to all the world? The end is the beautiful. The end is the beautiful. In other words, the beauty of existence, totally different from a contracted place. And what's the end of the practice of compassion? It's being in the experience of infinite space. Talk about space. It's the experience of infinite space. And what's the end of joy? I missed one. Equanimity is infinite space. And joy, the fruit, the end of joy is infinite consciousness. And yeah, compassion is infinite space. Joy is infinite consciousness. And equanimity is emptiness. So they seem very abstract, I know, but still there are states which are not so difficult. You can actually get a hint of them. So there's, with the fruit of working with the heart practice, the endlessness, the beyond the self, going right out, is these states of deep, deep sense of space, that we are made of space, we are part of space. We don't need to think about it. It's not something you need to worry about too much, but it's just good to know that right from the very earliest teaching, firstly, just what we're doing here, the practice of Brahma Viharas, the heart practices of love, compassion, and joy, are built on Vipassana style awareness practice, the factors of awakening, energy, concentration, attention, listening, seeing, knowing, truth, opening the truth. Secondly, they can be a vibration, a sense of being with the world. And thirdly, that they go to a place which is very, very spacious, and we can live like that instead of contracted place. So we here are working with all the tools that are in the tradition, and some over the years, to develop the two directions, the direction of spaciousness, direction of being more aware and free in the world, and the direction of being very aware of the heart, the power of the heart. And the two go together all the time. And it's kind of, we'll kind of keep meeting boundaries as we do that. We keep meeting our limits. And it's important that we meet the limits. And it's not a problem to meet the limits, ha-gvulot, and say, ah, ken, aval zeh gvul, ani lo rotze latet et zeh gam, ani lo rotze to give up this. I need love. No, it's the opposite. It's okay. We meet the boundary and push it a bit. We meet the boundary and push it. We meet the boundary and expand it. And this image of space is a very nice image. We'll meet ourselves, our limited self, and then we'll open it and we'll spread it. And it's the two, the awareness and the heart, that will do it. A final word, equanimity, and we're going to be bringing this up in this retreat. Equanimity is some ground which allows us to do this work. It's both the fruit of the practice. Equanimity is steadiness. And as I said today, the Buddha said, if you know the truth of things in this moment, it will bring you steadiness. Because what is not steady, when you get caught up in story and narrative and the way things should be and pressures and kind of get lost in the stories. If you connect with this moment of lived moment as it is, you will find yourself more steady. Pleasant, unpleasant. I can cope with that. I can cope with that. There's steadiness in that. So we're going to be actually a little bit working with that even from the beginning of the retreat, because it's important in these days. And as I said, the Buddha said, be an island to yourself in the stormy sea. How do you do that? I'm breathing. I'm aware. My body, the trees, the earth. That's it. And the mind. So Buddha said, if you're close and intimate with the moment, you will be steady. And I think all of us can feel that with the absolutely crazy times. But if we feel we're standing under a tree with our feet on the ground, I'm here. Okay. So I'm here. The world is totally crazy, but here I stand. So equanimity is very important, because it also helps us to the other Brahma Viharas, the love and the compassion and the joy. If there is a ground that we have, a sort of a solid ground underneath of steadiness, then it helps us to actually feel the love and the belonging without feeling we're lost. So the ground helps us in these days of difficulty, but it helps us with our practice as well. So one final thing about the sutta that I like. The Buddha reminds us that there is a point to all of this. It's not a technical practice. He said, what's the peak? The peak is something infinite. The peak of the practice, or where it's all going, is taking us to a place of infinite, aniskav, you could say, perhaps in Hebrew. There's something divine. It takes us there. This is not a technical practice. This is a practice that takes us to the divine. And the sutta expresses it. Something infinite, something that is unlimited. And it's good to remember that. We connect with the world, but the world is connected with us. We let go into the world if we invite. If we take refuge in the Buddha takes refuge in us. If we take refuge in the Dharma takes refuge in us. If we let go into the world without resistance, the world will let go into us. It's not entirely us to have to hold things. And it's good to remember that. A final little story that I've said before, maybe a few times, so you probably heard it, but it is relevant. When in Klil, one day I was standing watching the sky over Haifa, and it just stayed with me, such a strong image. And I was watching the sky and the color there towards the sunset, and all of a sudden there was two rockets appeared between me and the sky. And there was someone else with me, and the two of us watching it and say, wow, look at that. Yerutim interceptors came up somewhere between in Haifa. And then, boom. And we were looking at the sky, and it was strange. Both of us had a sense that the sky couldn't care less. And all of a sudden, we couldn't care less. Of course it's painful. The pain is there. No one's denying pain. But something in the bigger picture is such a compensating nechama. The bigger picture is for us a real nechama. And here in this retreat, we can give space. We can be in that space of the bigger picture. Okay, thank you. So we'll take a couple of minutes of quiet.